If you're stressed or depressed, anxious or just need a rest. If you're into your sport and you want to perform at your best, take a breath, take a breath, take a breath.
Take a breath. Today we've got a special guest, Andy Van Bergen from cyclingtips.com. Andy's been on a fantastic adventure that I'll get Andy to tell you about. It's a unique adventure that, if done in Australia, is a hard task. When you put him into context of where he went, it was a monumental task, a mountainous task. We'll talk about Andy's adventure, and I did a bit of work with Andy prior to Andy going away briefly with breathing, and we'll talk about how that helped.
Thank you very much for having me along.
Cycling Tips is, you were saying, it's the number one cycling...
Cycling Tips is an online media organisation. We're actually the largest cycling media outlet in Australia, up there in terms of the world. So yeah, it's got a big presence and mainly focused on the roadie market, I guess.
Have you always been into bikes?
Not...
Like since you were a kid, were you a mad, crazy bike kid?
Absolutely. So like I grew up, I think my first bike had a big banana seat, and I was always out riding my BMX and probably falling over more than... I seem to only be able to recall the crashes that I had, of which there were many. But yeah, but I've always loved cycling. I was a runner for a little while, like a trail runner. And it was actually, I think, that exposure to running up in the hills, and I'd see cyclists go past and it just looked so effortless that I thought, okay, maybe if I'm ever going to be a cyclist, it'd be a cyclist who rides up in the hills.
How did that evolve into Cycling Tips?
Yeah, I'm kind of fortunate actually. So Cycling Tips has been around for about 7 or 8 years or so, and I got put onto it when I was riding my bike, and it was just a great source of information on a little bit on racing, but it was really about the culture of cycling and kind of showcasing the beauty of the sport, I guess. Some of the storytelling that they were doing was just so engrossing. And in fact, for my day job, I was a 9-to-5 corporate job. That was my escape. I'd go to Cycling Tips every day and check out whatever had been posted. And then a few years later, I left that corporate gig, and somehow, like serendipity, I think, I was lucky enough to land a role at my favorite website to visit. So I've been working there for about 5 years or so. Absolute dream role, working and living in cycling.
So, well, you're in cycling gear, you're cycling to work.
Yeah, it's kind of part and parcel, I think. It's a great office. So we've grown from a team of 3 when I came on 5 years ago to now I think there's over 20 spread all over the globe. But yeah, there's absolutely no way that you could work in a cycling organisation without being a keen enthusiast yourself, I think. So we're all passionate about the sport and love the sport.
You mentioned your adventure. Tell us about your Everest.
Yeah, so again, like with Cycling Tips, we've been lucky enough to visit some pretty remote locations all over the world. We run a series called Road Tripping, where we highlight these little known destinations or give people, I guess, a roadmap on how to get there. As a bit of background, a couple of years ago, I invented a concept called Everesting, and I'll break that down for you. So really simply, you get on your bike and you ride up and down any hill anywhere in the world of any gradient or terrain or anything like that. You just keep on riding up and down that hill until you climb the equivalent height of Mount Everest in one ride. So it's 8,848 meters. We're here in Heidelberg, and there's Burgundy Street up the road. You could climb that, say it might be 200 repetitions of Burgundy Street to climb the equivalent height of Mount Everest, whereas you might go out to Mount Buller or the Stelvio or one of those iconic passes, and you may only need to ride it 5 or 7 or 8 times. So you do that anywhere in the world. That's a concept that's been in existence for 3 or 4 years. Over 2,500 people that have participated or completed this challenge in more than 70 countries. So through this road tripping series, there came an opportunity to actually, as ridiculous as it sounds, attempt an Everesting at Mount Everest itself. 3 to 6 months ago, before we went, they actually paved the road to Everest Base Camp on the Tibetan side of Mount Everest, which meant that all of a sudden you would be able to ride your road bike from anywhere in China all the way up to Everest Base Camp at 5,500 meters. Incredible.
Yeah. I've watched the video a few times actually, because it's extraordinary.
Yeah.
But both for what you did and just for the scene, like the scenery alone, it's a beautiful short film.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we're really lucky and fortunate to work with some of the best photographers and videographers in the industry. Like any experience like that, you see it and it gives a very good impression of what it's like. But to immerse yourself in that area and to be breathing in thin air and to, you know, the smells and the sounds and the sights in this full 360 degree panorama of being in the high Himalaya is just something I'll never forget in my life.
So as a leader, I first met Andy 2 weeks before he's about to leave to go to Everest, which was short notice.
Nothing like a cram.
Yeah. And he was training with a colleague at Matilda, who did it as well, at Melbourne Altitude Training Centre, which is down the road from where I was working. And I popped in to visit them at the Altitude Centre, basically with the idea that you can acclimatise to altitude to make your body more efficient at, or, you know, you increase the red blood cell count so your body is more efficient at taking up oxygen. I was there and said, yeah, that's great. If I have my body's more efficient at taking up oxygen, it's fantastic. But what dictates how you get that oxygen to your cells for energy production is how you breathe. So if you breathe in efficiently, you don't get the oxygen to your cells. So you can increase the effect of altitude by learning how to breathe. Through Oz, I met Andy and we started to do a little bit of work with breathing. However, with 2 weeks out, it wasn't enough time for us to really make significant changes in terms of increasing in tolerance to hypercapnia or elevated CO2, or really making massive changes to how they breathe while they were cycling up the hill.
Obviously, you've been training for a long time previously. Had you been training specifically for a long time before?
Definitely. So we've been training for about 6 months in the lead up. I think one of the things that was kind of tricky for us, knowing how to train and how to prepare our body best for this, was that the more we researched it, the more we realized there was no benchmark for what we were doing.
For that altitude cycling.
I would call it endurance cycling at altitude. Yep. So to put it in context, we knew we were looking down the barrel of around about 36 hours without sleep. And that was kind of best case scenario to complete this challenge. And all of it at altitude, and obviously 8,848 meters of climbing in there as well. So we're putting our bodies under tremendous stress, taking on this challenge wherever you are in the world, but add in the extra factors of the temperature, which was going to be down to -8, the wind, and then the altitude. There's no benchmark that we could draw on to kind of simulate those sorts of effects. So the training, was about 6 months, and we're trying out all these different things and trying to understand how we could best prepare our body. And one of the regrets, I've got to say, is that we didn't get onto Tim earlier, because the wealth of knowledge that was there is unparalleled. It was amazing hearing him talk through how we could have prepared our bodies. And I wish we would have gone in from the start and had a little bit more time to prepare. I've got to say, like, probably the biggest, I don't know what you want to call it, like, card up our sleeve on that trip was actually the breathing exercises. I found myself relying on that multiple times every single day.
And that's one of the reasons why we decided to set up this podcast, was that the understanding or the knowledge is just not out there about breathing yet. It's easy to say, you know, we have done that earlier, and it's starting to grow now with people hear about, let's say, a Wim Hof, or they hear about certain things. And we'll get on to later what you discussed about one of the cycling teams now pulling a breathing coach, but it's just one of those things. So that's why we were doing a podcast. It takes a few months to learn how to change your breathing as you're ascending, for example. It's hard enough that you're at altitude in bloody cold conditions, already stressed, but then trying to breathe more efficiently while you're doing that might have thrown a bit on. So what we decided to focus on was, we did a little bit of that hypercapnic, sort of hypoxic work in prior to then going, but only a tiny bit. But what was important was more was teaching how to diaphragm breathe so you can relax. So I figured the one area we could make an impact is when they're descending back down the hill. If you can learn how to breathe more efficiently, you can get your heart rate back down to resting heart rate, aerobic heart rate quicker, and then how to breathe for relaxation. And so that was sort of the focus. So the exercise that we focused on were around that.
So Andy, or how much training had you put into breathing as such? Like, on the bike, I'm not really familiar with sort of road cycling and sort of training regimes, but do you consciously think about your breathing? Like a cyclist, are they working on their breathing? Are they manipulating their breathing? Or are they just trying to get the air in as much as they can?
I guess the only time where I've noticed it myself, and I can't speak for other cyclists, so I'd start by saying it's not common knowledge. It's not somewhere you would go to, I guess, you know, increase performance or anything like that. For example, Tim mentioned the Trek team that are studying with a deep sea diver, and we can go into that later, but that's the first I've ever heard of anyone considering breathing as part of their cycling. Maybe the only place you might dip into that is, say, if you've got a Pilates or a yoga background, and sometimes you'll utilize that breathing to isolate different muscle groups and things like that. So you can, you know, switch to a core or focus on using glutes instead of quads or whatever it might be. But it's fairly simplistic. That's what was so exciting about talking to Tim, and why even 2 weeks out we realized that we would have had that conversation so much earlier as well, because not just particularly for this trip at altitude, but there's just so much knowledge there to tap into. It just would have been great, like, going into that a lot earlier.
One of the things that sparked my interest, and we talked about this earlier, in breathing, apart from the fact that I'd always been interested in it, but something that really made me sit up was I read a book called Tour de Force, which most, any avid cyclist would be aware of the book. It was written by a journalist about Lance Armstrong before the shit hit the fan, and talked about his training and how his training was unbelievably fine-tuned. It was amazing. It was fascinating. And the doctor that he worked with for his programs was a doctor named Dr. Ferrari. He was very, very, very well known in the sports training world, because I believe he was involved in the pioneering of the sort of training where you train at certain levels of millimoles of lactic acid and what have you. And I remember when I was paddling full-time, we were dabbling or starting to learn that type of training in the early 90s. But anyway, Dr. Ferrari, in the book, they asked him where he felt improvements in sport would come from moving down the track, and he looked at it and said, well, the training side of it and programming side of it, you know, there's a few percent left, but we're really on top of that a lot. With regards to recovery, maybe a little bit more, but not a lot left. He said, really, one of the areas that we don't understand a lot about, he believed was possible that they could, a lot of progress could be made, or a lot of developments and improvements, was in the area of breathing. That made me pay attention to it, and he was onto that back in, can't remember when it was written, probably late 90s, early, oh, probably OOs, I think, when the book was written.
Yeah, that's right.
He'd alluded to it, but then nothing was being done at the time. So it's probably only recently that things have started to be done.
So, Andy, post-Everesting, has it changed the way you've thought about your cycling, or changed the way that you're sort of training, or...
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess in a number of areas. So like I said, when we were preparing for this, it was really fascinating, actually, like going through the effect of nutrition, or we had sweat tests, for example, to determine like the amount of sodium we need to replace in our bodies. We're doing altitude training with Oz at Melbourne Altitude Centre. We had multiple blood tests throughout. Our bloods always came back great. But for example, you know, the amount of iron that you need in your body needs to be so much higher when you're going to be doing anything endurance wise at altitude, because your red blood cell production needs to increase. So therefore, you know, the precursor or the building blocks of that is iron, obviously. All these things that came about from that was really fascinating learning about going into the cycling. That said, I've got to say, like, a lot of that was focused specifically on altitude. So I think that the reason why the breathing was of so much interest was because that's probably the one thing that, yes, it helped at altitude, but there are benefits that could be made for just regular cycling. Yeah, it was quite fascinating.
We talked about the idea of what an Everesting is and the fact that you went to Everest. Having read the article, it was fascinating once you were in that context, you're at Everest. You mentioned a little bit before, but tell us a bit about, firstly, what you went through, and then secondly, how did you use the breathing to help?
As you mentioned, like, both Matilda and I were practicing these techniques and using them. So we flew in to Lhasa, which is just under 4,000 metres. So that was our introduction. Usually you acclimatise for a few weeks before you get to that point. You might acclimatise at about 4,000 metres for, again, a couple of weeks. For example, there is actually a marathon that goes over, I believe it's the Friendship Road, which is fairly high. So it'd reach about 5,500 metres. And in preparation for that marathon, at a minimum, people are spending at least a month acclimatising there. And more typically 2 months. We had about 3 days or so before we were heading up and slowly gaining altitude. So it's pretty tough on the body. We prepared ourselves as best we can, but that was just the lot that we'll cast. We don't have the luxury of spending 2 months away from our families and our job, unfortunately. That said, like, every individual reacts differently at altitude. You've probably heard of HACE and HAPE, which is pulmonary edema and high altitude cerebral edema. They're the two areas that you're likely to be affected by altitude. So unfortunately, fortunately, as it transpires, you're either genetically predisposed to high altitude sickness or not. And I was one of those unfortunate few who is susceptible to cerebral, so HACE. Basically, what that meant for me was my blood oxygen saturation levels would dip really quickly. Like right now, at sea level, our blood oxygen saturation levels are around 99%. Under duress, in a simulated altitude environment, for example, at the training center, mine might dip down like below 90% into the 80s. That's starting to get a warning zone. I think generally, if you weren't simulating that altitude, if you were to get under 90, that would be a danger zone kind of.
When I was a physio in hospital, if someone's under 90, they're on oxygen.
To give you a bit of an idea, during the actual Everesting itself, as well as in the lead up to, but during the Everesting itself, obviously we're putting our body under a fair amount of duress. We had a blood oxygen saturation meter and mine got down to 49. So 49% was where I pulled the pin. At that point, I had been experiencing all the crazy hallucinations that you can imagine. I was literally off with the fairies. I was prepared to bleed through my eyeballs to complete this challenge. I'm a pretty determined sort of person. I've done six of these before. I know endurance sport. I know the mental side of things, and I was prepared to push myself beyond anything I'd ever done before, but it was out of my hands. I guess at the point before I pulled the pin, I'd almost shot off a guardrail. I was having out-of-body experiences. It was not pleasant, I think, is probably the best way to describe it. Yeah, 49% was my blood sats.
I think in the article you mentioned something about one of the doctors that said if we saw that in hospital, they'd expect you to be...
Oh, you'd be on every machine, I think it was her exact...
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously a very different environment, but that was a pretty dire situation, actually. So I had to try and elevate it back to a healthy 80%, which again is very, very low. I think we managed to get it back to the kind of 70s and 80s after about 20 minutes or so, and it was just relying on the breathing techniques that we'd been given.
How were you using the breathing techniques in the context when you were away?
Tim had set me up with a breathing routine which would help restore my oxygen levels just by slowing my breathing down. It was a simple pattern. I'm going to get this pattern wrong, so I think it was... Can you help me out with the amount of time? The ratio?
In for three, hold for five, out for five.
Yeah, I was going to get that ratio wrong. That's the one. It was actually perfect. So I could just sit there. I'd put on some music. Just, you know, go through this routine of slowing the exhale, I think is the big thing.
Yeah,
and then a slight hold.
Between inhale and exhale.
Exactly.
Slowing the exhale, definitely.
And it sounds really counterintuitive when you feel like you're gasping for air, and it is a little bit difficult to get started, but you just close your eyes and get into that. And usually almost within the first 5 minutes, I'd see a big spike in those blood oxygen saturation levels again. And then it would sort of, you know, like a bit of a curve, it would take another couple of minutes to get it back to something which was a little bit more acceptable. Yeah, funnily enough, I mean, I mentioned that 49% when that was at kind of the peak of the duress that we're going to put our bodies under. But I would find I would use that technique if we were in the bus driving over a mountain pass. All of a sudden I'd start to feel anxiety levels rise because breathing became a little bit more difficult. It's just a case of switching off for a couple of moments, slipping into that breathing routine for 5 to 10 minutes, and I'd be right as rain again.
Okay, so a bit of a nerd alert here. There are two sides to it with those breathing rhythms, just to explain a little bit for anyone listening. Firstly, if you slow down your breathing, most people overbreathe, so we breathe too quickly and with too much volume. So with those rhythms, we get people to breathe through their nose, which will reduce the volume, and they use their diaphragm. But slowing down the breathing rate and extending the exhale will increase carbon dioxide levels. And carbon dioxide is the limiting factor in breathing, in that if your carbon dioxide levels are higher, you'll deliver oxygen to the cells more efficiently. So the point there is, if oxygen saturations are low, it makes you more efficient by slowing your breathing down.
So could you breathe through your nose, like that altitude, could your nose breathe?
Yeah, absolutely. So that was a big part of the
technique. Not up the hill.
Yeah, up the hill is a bit different. It's sort of interesting because I guess the threshold that we were hitting, not just on the Everesting attempt itself, but in all the riding that we did to lead up to that at altitude, it's not so much the high level of effort. Your threshold's very different than at sea level. You're doing everything at a slower pace. So you've got to use every tool in your belt, I guess. Breathing through your nose is something we definitely do, particularly when trying to recover afterwards.
Second side of the nerd alert, by learning how to use your diaphragm properly, well, of all of the functions controlled by our autonomic nervous system, which is also the nervous system that controls the stress response or regulates the stress response, breathing is the one we can consciously control. So if you learn how to diaphragm breathe properly, you can then kick yourself into the relaxation response more than fight or flight. For example, Andy mentioned, as he goes over a mountain pass and he starts to get anxious, then you're more likely to hyperventilate and be in fight or flight. so I can change my breathing. As they say in America, I can biohack my nervous system so that I'm more relaxed, basically. And so those rhythms were designed not only to make you more efficient at producing energy and using oxygen, but also to relax your nervous system.
It was really interesting as well, because the anxiety was, I guess, when we weren't riding at effort or anything like that, but this would happen typically a few times a day. You'd notice your anxiety levels increase as the breathing got a little bit more difficult, which then just turned into this negative feedback loop. So because you were more anxious, you were more stressed, your breathing becomes more labored, and it would just, turn into this big cycle. So it was good after a few days, we could really see, okay, well, this is the trigger. So as soon as you felt that coming on, you had to kind of have a bit of a mental break there and go, okay, hang on, I recognize that I'm about to slip into this anxiety-triggered breathing episode. Yeah. And you could just straight away kind of nip it in the bud a little bit by just focusing on relaxing and breathing a little bit more. So we would all do it at different times.
A friend of mine recently did the
Three Peaks.
Three Peaks.
Yeah.
What would be your sort of top tips for someone who's going
top
into that?
Particularly for hill climbing, I think if I can use it in terms of how you might use muscles on the flat, it's all about efficiency. So you've got a very efficient way of moving your body and moving through space. When you start to climb, typically what happens is there comes a point where you start to redline a little bit, and then all that just goes out the door, and your arms are sloppy and your legs are sloppy and you become less efficient. And it's easy to be conscious of that because you see it in a physical way. As cyclists, the one thing we never rely on is that with breathing, because that's exactly the same. And after this trip, that's the one thing I've noticed the most. Like, you know, we breathe very efficiently when we're on the bike, but as soon as we go into that duress, all of a sudden that's out the door and you're just gasping for air, and you're just trying to suck in big lungfuls of air, and that's like throwing your shoulders back. You're trying to open up your chest, and that's changing the way you are on the bike and everything like that.
You're less efficient creating energy as well.
Yeah.
Lactic acid.
Well, imagine the amount of energy that's required to suck in those big lungfuls of air. You're actually just, again, it's similar to that negative feedback loop that I was talking about. You're just exacerbating the problem.
It's similar sort of thing with someone who has asthma when they're airways are closing down, so they're trying to work harder.
The response is to work harder.
That's right. Yeah. And you're using more muscles, but it's much more efficient.
Well, it's actually exacerbates the symptoms.
That's right.
And I guess I mentioned that because with examples with muscles, you know, we see that and we're conscious of that as cyclists. But the one thing we're not conscious of is that effect on breathing. And it was such a light bulb moment, I think, in the riding afterwards. It was like, we just don't even think about this. And it's exactly the same.
Well, I found it really cool to read the article and even chatting now, because brief time, but it was fantastic. Like, I've seen the effect, and I've seen the effect in clinic for the reasons you talked about. If I'm having an asthma attack and I'm starting to sort of hyperventilate, for the same reasons that it can help sport, it also can help asthmatics. So I've seen that repeatedly in clinic. But it's great seeing the application of other people, because I found when I started applying it, you know, we become the human guinea pig, so to speak, and I was teaching myself how to nose diaphragm breathe for sport with the understanding that, you know, it's more efficient. And it took a few months, and I started to find that I was more efficient. I did a race. My background is paddling, and I did the Molokai race, which is like the Molokai paddle race is a four-hour race or 53K race, so 4 hours depending on who you are. And it's the equivalent for the ocean paddling world of the Hawaii Ironman for triathlon. It's the world, unofficial world endurance trail championships. And I learned how to nose breathe. So I basically, apart from the first 10-15 minutes where we don't take off slowly, we take off fairly quickly, and I was sort of half nose, half mouth. But after about 15-20 minutes, I settled into a nose diaphragm breathing pattern the whole way, and found that I came home like a train. I normally wasn't a fast finisher. That was really exciting, and so I started using it with a couple of other people and seeing how they found it. It was similar sort of results, because there's not a lot of studies that have been done with athletes and sport yet, unfortunately. It'd be great to see people apply it, and it'd be good to do some more studies where we can apply it to say, okay, yes, it's helped you relax, but let's apply it more. How does it help with performance? Because I know, well, I've experienced it, I've had other people experience it, it'd be great to see it.
Can you say how you actually apply it? If you're probably not using it on a flat, as you say, but when you've been doing hill stuff or harder stuff, well, what do you actually say to yourself, or how?
Yeah, so I think it's one of those things, like Tim alluded to before, I think you have to be, like any new technique, I use the Pilates example. So I was doing Pilates for many years and, you know, was able to consciously switch between muscle groups if required. So you could consciously engage core or consciously engage glutes and things like that. And you sort of find that for the first however many months until it becomes a bit of a muscle memory, you need to call on that consciously. So you need to be aware of the fact that you need to call on that, and then you need to consciously make that trigger. And what I found was after a couple of months with this Pilates example, it had just happened unconsciously. I would actually realize it afterwards, go, oh, there we go, I've switched my breathing now, and I am engaging different muscle groups. And although I'm not at that point with breathing, I think I'm at the point that I feel that I'm conscious of the fact that my breathing is stepping out of rhythm a little bit, and I need to check that quickly. On the flat, for example, generally you'll be breathing through your nose and out through your mouth. Everything's about efficiency, so it's just a very slow, efficient sort of process. When you start climbing in the hills, maybe you might, just out of necessity, you need to breathe through your mouth a little bit more. But it's when you kind of hit that red zone that it all just gets thrown out the window, and you're just gasping for air, basically, probably dribbling a little bit, and you know, whatever it is, you basically, everything's out the door. And
I know that feeling.
It's at that point where you need to be able to switch on, and it sounds counterintuitive, but relax your breathing while you're under duress, because again, otherwise you're only going to exacerbate that issue.
The important thing with that is you can learn to know in nose and out nose. That's actually more efficient, to in and out through the nose. First time I tried that, I take my mouth shut and went for a paddle. It's funny because I was on the river in my kayak and I paddled past a couple of rowers, and the looks they gave me was...
There's a challenge for you, Andy.
Morning, Tim.
I used that porous paper tape called Microport tape. I didn't use... But anyway, cut a long story short, and I hyperventilated with my nose and got a headache. So my body wasn't ready for it, B, my brain wasn't ready for it. So I didn't actually improve my breathing. All I did was hyperventilated using my nose. So you have to learn it over time. It's not something you can go and do straight away. You can learn to do that. But what's more important is that you, I found with a colleague that we will interview, this colleague of mine who's head coach at Western Australian Institute of Sport kayak program, and he's worked a lot with breathing as well. We've found that you can nose breathe up to about an anaerobic threshold. And then once you get above AT, you've got to go to mouth because the demands are higher. But what's more important is that you can, is your diaphragm breathe, is that you learn to breathe using your diaphragm, whereas most of us will go suck using our chest and shoulders. Now that's emergency breathing, whereas if we start it with our diaphragm and then bring the chest in, that's much more efficient. And you can start that below AT, and once you get to AT, even if you have to use mouth, you'll be much more efficient. So that's something that can be learned.
And I guess you're crossing that threshold into the red line, like being conscious of, of that breathing as well. That's probably the difference, rather than trying to claw it back later.
Yeah. So it's a thing that takes time, and it's being aware of it and training with it so that you can practice it. So that when you are in that mode where you're redlining and you're going up a hill and you're dribbling and you're feeling when's this going to end and what have you, then it becomes more automatic. If you have to think too much about it, it's not going to work.
It's probably also worth talking about the other area, which maybe some cyclists do by default a little bit. In cycling, generally we try to stay below threshold wherever possible. Everyone's got different thresholds, because if you're in that red line or red zone, then you're just burning sugars. It's not efficient. You can do it for a small amount of time, but that's about it. But
you're doing that below AT, anaerobic threshold?
That's correct, yeah. So I guess when you are redlining, you have to do that to sprint back on, to catch someone's wheel, or to get over a crest, but as long as you can come back to a below AT, that's really important. So I think the other area is how we recover on the bike as quickly as possible and get your heart rate back down as quickly as possible. So it's crucial, essentially. And the quicker you can do that and get back to efficiency, the better it is. It's better in the long term.
And so the next challenge for you, Andy?
It sounds really bizarre, but with Everesting, I mentioned you can do it on any hill anywhere in the world. This latest trend is to do it on a program called Zwift. It's sort of hard to explain, but you jump on a trainer, you know, like a wind trainer in your house, and it's hooked up to Bluetooth, and you actually ride. Your computer screen shows you a virtual world. Think like Avatar or like Warcraft. I don't play any of those computer games, but it's like a online virtual environment essentially called Zwift. It's incredible. It's a great training buddy. And not only can you see your own little avatar riding in this virtual environment, but you then see anyone else in the world who's riding in Zwift as well. So you could be riding alongside someone from London in real time. This world is incredible and it's really immersive. They've got a simulated course in London. They've got one that's, you climb up a big volcano. So you can be climbing for 40 minutes, like up into the snow and everything in this virtual environment. Anyway, so the big thing is that virtual Everesting has become a bit of a thing. So I actually, the trainer responds to you climbing a hill. It makes it harder, like adds resistance for you. So yeah, as part of my training for the trip to Everest last year, 2 weeks out, I did a virtual Everesting. So I spent a good 19 hours on the trainer in my garage. It sounds terrible, but there was just something in it which was actually kind of appealing. So midway through this year and around July or so, we're going to have a big group virtual Everesting where we'll try and get, who knows, maybe a couple of hundred people to all attempt an Everesting at once.
From around the world.
From around the world. So they're all doing it simultaneously on the road, and you'll see 100 people all making this attempt at once.
That's the funny thing about the virtual world, is that
it's crazy.
They can be in, you wouldn't know, unless you're online, you would not know. They'll be in their garage or their lounge room somewhere
exactly.
around the world, and you don't have to amass in one spot.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's still your ride. You're doing it solo, but it's kind of in solidarity.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it should be a bit of fun. So that's midway through this year.
Wow. What I should mention is they did a fantastic video that Matt mentioned about the Everesting trip, and Andy also wrote a fantastic article. In our show notes, we'll link the article, and in the article has the video as well. It's definitely worth a read. It's a fantastic read. Definitely worth a watch of the video. One of the main things is just the photos and the scenery was just extraordinary. I was just gobsmacked. It was fantastic.
It was a once-in-a-lifetime adventure, yeah. That's for sure.
Well, I was just blown away when I would even try it.
Yeah. I won't give away the ending. You can probably guess what happens. But if you're planning on doing any riding, there's plenty of riding options in the world. For example, where you do hit altitude or high altitude. For example, if you're riding in Hawaii, there's a big stonking volcano there called Haleakala. I think it's over 3,000 meters. If you're riding in Bolivia or Colombia or wherever it might be, there's plenty of opportunity to, on a bike, ride in altitude conditions. And I guess my biggest tip is, do a bit of research, chat to someone about how you can utilize breathing technique in the lead up. Again, it was probably the most beneficial thing we had in our back pocket when we were ever on our trip. And again, I just wish that we would have had the time to practice some of these techniques in the months leading up and better prepare our bodies. But the little bit of insight that we got made such a huge difference.
We might have to do some work prior to the virtual.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So if anyone is interested in looking into it further, and jump onto cyclingtips.com. They have membership. There's stacks of information, whether it be nutrition, or you can tell us a bit more, but there's all sorts of cycling trips, gear.
You can immerse yourself in some incredible stories as well. Yeah, yeah. We love telling a story on Cycling Tips.
Well, that story, the Everesting story, is a ripper. Yeah.
Thanks very much, Andy.
Thank you so much for having me today, guys. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's great. And if anyone's interested in looking it up further, if you're a sports person or someone wanting to learn to breathe, or a surfer or someone wanting to learn to breathe more efficiently, or you suffer from asthma, then jump on our website, takeabreath.com.au. We can teach breathing in groups, so we can do performance breathing courses with groups, or we can work one-on-one. Jump on. Have a look. Got some cool videos as well.